Hello, everybody. I'm Phil Margavichus, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. Building MedTech companies the right way based on great technology is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable MedTech technology with their business goals. This in turn builds those clients into successful, thriving companies with strong experience and depth in the startup, venture capital, intellectual property, and fundraising arenas. McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the MedTech business that you envision. In this episode, Kevin Sam at Zapyrus and Dwayne Mancini discuss what Zapyrus does, their 2023 MedTech report on the industry, and so much more.
Okay, Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kevin, a introduction into who you are, your background in the space, and then what you're currently doing with Zapyrus.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Happy to do so. So my background, I guess I come from a mixed background. My official responsibility right now, I'm the brand lead of Zapyrus. It's a business intelligent platform, the only one really built for commercial teams in the medtech space. Specifically, service providers are our main customers at the moment. And my background, I came from the lab. So I started my roots in chemistry straight off undergrad, and then went to do a PhD in chemistry. That led to a bunch of work in materials, kind of engineering, point of care diagnostics, all in the application of diagnostics for infectious diseases and oncology. So from there, after academia, I went over to France a little bit, spent some time there working in a liquid biopsy startup company for oncology applications as well. And so spent a little bit of time there before COVID, and then post-COVID came back to Canada, and then out came Zapyrus out of that. So that's a bit about my background.
Very cool. I forgot that you were a chemist. Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Interesting transition, right? From chemistry to now this. I guess walk me through that a little bit more from like a career transition standpoint for you. You know, I think that's always interesting. I think there's a lot people can learn from that where, you know, you're in a specific field, but you've kind of transitioned into doing something different. So I'm just curious if you can expand on that a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess there wasn't an official kind of set in stone rubric that I followed to say, like, I'm going to make this career transition and, you know, go away from research and all that, or even enter research in the first place. Like when I went into science and the academic space, it was really from my background experience growing up in Cambodia, where I was exposed early to the impacts of portable point of care diagnostics when I grew up there in the early 90s. Through the AIDS epidemic down in Southeast Asia there. And so I saw kind of what the UN brought in terms of assistance and the Red Cross for being able to quickly diagnose and determine what the disease was, who had it, and really control the spread of that disease. Right. And so from there, I wanted to do something in that space. I just knew kind of I wanted to be in the healthcare space somehow. So when I went to school, chemistry was one of those degrees where it's kind of an intersect between biology and physics, a bit of engineering as well, with options to apply that knowledge to build and create things. So I was always chasing after impact. And that kind of is my North Star that drives me forward in kind of everything I do. And so that impact led me to go into research because I wanted to build things, build diagnostic tests, you know, build new innovative things. And so when I went in there, that's when I discovered like, okay, this is a new way to learn things, right? To really be experimental, really make mistakes quick. And one of the first things I learned was, let's just make the most mistakes quickly in a controlled environment as fast as possible so that you rule all that out so you can get to the answer and the solution much faster. And so from that kind of philosophy, I took a typical four-year kind of PhD term, turned that into about 16 publications and around 2 patents out of that. So hyper productive in the 4 years. I was kind of 12-hour days, yeah. You know, from the lab to home, to the gym, and then back to the lab. It was super focused. From there, all that work led to me deciding, like, do I stay in academia or do I kind of try my hands at industry? And that's when I started to uncover the world of management consulting and things like that. And so the business world. That really piqued my interest in taking that research and translating it into startups and businesses and bringing those patents really to fruition and impacting the end customers or end users, which at that time were patients. And so that got me interested in the business side. And that was when that transition happened, was again chasing after that impact, which led me to decide, okay, let me step outside of academia and see kind of what the industry and the world outside of academia was all about. And that took me to France to work in that startup company.
Very cool. Love the background. So I wanted to ask, at all the times we've talked, I don't think I knew you were from Cambodia. And so 170 some episodes in, we finally have our first Cambodian, I guess, on the podcast. And for those listening in too, because this is this is a global audience. So for those who are wondering where Cambodia is in Southeast Asia, it's positioned, I think, between Thailand and maybe Vietnam and on the coast a little bit there. That's really cool, Kevin. I did not know that. So Kevin, tell me a little bit about Zapyrus. Zapyrus and Project MedTech, we do have a nice partnership, and so I know the tool because I've been using it. But for those who don't know what Zapyrus does, maybe just give it a little more insight into what you all do.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are not the traditional kind of data company. Right, we specialize in a very niche vertical of ours, which is med tech. And so our data captures global information around med tech companies of all sizes, right? From early inception, let's say they don't even have a website yet, right? They're just coming online, to those ones that are going through merger and acquisitions and those large med tech companies that are acquiring those companies and creating like investment firms and things outside of their business, right? Their revenue. So we track anything and all in between, right? From there, we apply a layer of machine learning. We have an in-house built natural language processing engine that we apply to the data to be able to work alongside our users in a business setting. So So our primary users are business developers, so sales teams, marketing teams in the service provider space, to help them make meaningful decision around business, when to approach a business, when to go and chase after a certain opportunity at the right time. And so it helps to reduce the time spent on noise so you can focus on identifying the right signals at that time. Those are kind of our core audiences at the moment. There's other use cases where you stumbled upon this as well, Dwayne, right? Market assessment, understanding, you know, who in the market should we focus on? What is our total addressable market in the medtech space? Or who our competitors are in that space, right? That type of intel is done in real time. So we bring it in real time. As we're talking now, there's financial releases happening in the platform, and our users are accessing that data in real time. So that's kind of the way we differentiate here. It's purpose built for not only the medtech vertical, but for the user persona that's using it, which is business developers.
Yeah, that's great. So in February, you released a MedTech by the Numbers, or Zapyrus' MedTech in the Numbers 2023 report. We think we shared it in our on LinkedIn. We also shared it in our Project MedTech newsletter for that month. But, you know, just curious if I think what we wanted to talk about today was kind of to go through that, right? And so learning what we were, or kind of going through the numbers in 2023 is always helpful to help figure out, okay, well, what could happen in 2024, make predictions, those kind of things. So anyways, I'm curious, like let's walk through, you know, some of these various things that you found, within this report, but also maybe what you were trying to analyze in the report as well. Cause I think that's important to maybe set the stage for it. There's a, you know, a ton of different reports you can read on the med tech industry, and there's a lot of data, but you know, how you look at the data, or what you want to see is, you know, kind of tells you how you look at the data. So I'm just curious on, you know, what were some of the things you were trying to extract from all the data you were collecting?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to provide that context. So the report was originally aimed at supporting our users and our clients in meaningful decision-making for their business, right? What we found was that these high-level reports in the market, you know, reporting different numbers in the market for med tech across different therapeutic areas and sectors, were really rough estimates at best. And we thought we could do a much better job at maybe humbling the data a little bit, right? Not inflating the numbers, but giving actual financial numbers that we can trace it back to the individual dollar in the event that we've picked up in 2023 within that medtech space, so that it can give people a worst case scenario to work off of. Right? Like the worst as it gets is this number here. It's not lower than this. So that was our benchmark to say, like, worst case scenario, how do we prepare for 2024 with the 2023 financials post COVID pandemic? Because we saw an influx of funding, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me pause you right there too. That type of analysis is crucial. As a business owner, but also as a business owner of a company that supports other startups, you have to look at that way. It's the only way to make, you know, certain decisions and to know that, okay, yeah, I am going to have enough juice to get through these downturns, right? So, I just wanted to pause you there because I love that. But carry on with where were you going with that? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We thought it would resonate with users, with readers as well, with that report, if we took it from that approach. And the reason why we did it that way was we saw a huge influx in the IVD funding in the middle of COVID, because people were trying to bring in diagnostic test for COVID really quickly, right? And so that funding came in. And then there was this cliff, like the following year, of funding either dropping or being withheld because of that uncertainty of like, there's no more demand for COVID diagnostics. So do we continue to invest in diagnostics and medical device in general? Couple that with the uprising of ChatGPT and the whole large language generative AI model, and combining that with diagnostic instrumentation and medical devices and connected devices and things like that. The money was going all over the place. And that uncertainty caused some sort of a panic in the market that we saw in 2023. And so we were hearing that, you know, people weren't getting investments, or investors don't have any money. Some were saying investors don't have any cash to give. Others were saying, you know, founders are holding on to their money. And so we wanted to give more visibility into that cash flow. And that's how this report was born. And so the $18 billion that we report have already been separated from revenue reportings. So we're not including that, because revenue is great for those revenue generating companies, but it's not good for us to evaluate the health of innovation in startups and scale ups, where the funding is not coming from revenue. It's coming from, you know, investors, grants, and all the other forms of funding, right? So that $18 billion is capturing that aspect.
Right. That makes sense. And in this report, it says, of the investments supported, 11% of the med tech market in 2023. Explain to me what that means.
Yeah. So that 11% is 11% of the number of med tech companies in total in the market. So 11% of the med tech market receive that $18 billion. The rest did not see that funding.
Gotcha. Okay. Understood. And then I think the other important thing too, is separating the preclinical, clinical, commercial. So how did you kind of define those areas? And also from a, like med tech startup perspective, where did that funding go in 2023, and what did that look like?
Yeah. So we took companies and we segmented them into those three stages. So preclinical were any companies that were working on a device that have not entered the clinical stage, even the first round of clinical, right? If you're talking about feasibility studies, first in human, they haven't done that yet. So those are all of those startups. They may be in design prototype stage, testing stage, some basic lab animal kind of validation stuff, but they haven't entered clinical. That's that pool. And then the second pool is they have entered clinical, or the funds are being used to support clinical studies at all stages of clinical studies. So it could be pivotal, early feasibility, feasibility, first in human, that type of stuff. And then commercial is funding to basically say, we got FDA approval, we got EU approval, we need this funding to then scale out the commercial launch, right? So for manufacturing, for all the other stuff that's related to commercial launch. That's how we've segmented that. What was interesting, what was interesting is we saw almost an exact 50% split between the funds that were used in preclinical stage, so about $5.4 billion, to the funds that were invested in clinical, which is $10.5 billion, which we know that there's less companies that make it to clinical, but those the money needed to come out of clinical successful is higher, right, to run those clinical trials and make it through. So that was really interesting to see.
Yeah, and the commercial side was low, which is interesting to me, because that's where you see a lot of big rounds. I'm wondering if that had to do with the fact that, you know, a lot of times when you see total dollars invested, they're specifically speaking about, you know, venture capital dollars. And so you'd probably generally see more of that in the commercial space, but because yours includes not just VC, but I'm sure private equity, family office, angels, but also non-dilutive capital such as grants, I'm guessing that's why there's more in this preclinical clinical phase.
Exactly. And that shows you kind of the pipeline almost of companies coming through, right? So for businesses trying to get a good estimation of like, okay, what is the health of funding for a company at this stage? If you're in the preclinical stage, there's a healthy amount of funding at that stage from 2023. This surprised a lot of people actually, because there was kind of crosstalk, like I mentioned earlier, that, oh, there's no funding in the market. There's no funding in the market. And so commercial leaders are like, that's why my pipeline's empty, because there's no funding in the market. But then when you look at the numbers, it's actually, well, there's enough funding in the market where it doesn't fully explain that, right?
Kevin, I think this is interesting data, right? Because, you know, for the startups that Project MedTech works with, which are generally pre-commercial companies, and we probably work with them until maybe $3 million in annual revenue, right? You know, this is good to see that there is investments going into that preclinical clinical phase. So heavy amount of money of that 18 going into preclinical clinical stage companies. Graphic, I guess, that was in the report was funded med tech companies. And so maybe walk us through this one and the stages they were at.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you saw was almost a complete flip between the ratios of clinical versus preclinical graph from above, right? Where you saw the total clinical funding amount was double that of preclinical, which means there's more, two times the amount of money supporting clinical initiatives than preclinical initiatives, right? But when you go look at the number of companies that receive that funding, it flipped completely. So there's 50% less companies at the clinical stage receiving double the amount of money versus companies in the preclinical stage is two times more, receiving half the amount of money. So the split, the fight between that, right, is interesting.
That is really interesting. I think the next number is even more interesting to me. Like the fact that you said, you know, because clinical trials are expensive, right? So for those who are listening and maybe don't know, preclinical studies are expensive. Clinical studies are a whole new beast. And so the fact that, you know, with my background being in different CROs, that number doesn't shock me. What does shock me is the number of companies in device, med tech specifically, clinical was 518 and commercial was 173. That almost like, with commercial being like 20% of the clinical, that number is actually shocking to me. I'm surprised that many companies fall out there, whether it be, I guess, maybe funding issues or subpar clinical results. That one is really interesting, actually. I would wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, the drop-off is huge, right? Like you see a 50% drop-off in successful companies coming out of preclinical to clinical. You see like a doubling of that towards commercial. I think the factors that play into commercial success is beyond clinical success. Like you have a twofold factor, right? You have market pressures, you have reimbursements, you have also the clinical results where like you don't fully understand the product market fit until you launch also. So there's like a multivariable problem that just increases almost exponentially as soon as you get FDA approval or EU approval, where it kind of makes sense if you evaluate from that perspective. Like it's harder, not easier. People assume that clinical, getting through clinical validation study is the hardest thing. But what the number is showing, that's not really the case because the drop-off is higher post clinical. So it's almost the preparation leading into commercial launch is really, really important to get that right also, right? From crossing your T's and dotting your I's.
Yeah, I mean, this number right here, I think to your point, right, is like it halved and then it more than halved. But if you just take 896 and preclinical down to 173 of commercial, this is why in that preclinical phase, it is so crucial to not just do a reimbursement assessment or a regulatory assessment, but like you should start putting together a preliminary commercialization strategy. Like it's never too early to start thinking through that. You don't have to be spot on, right? But you should be thinking about that then because the statistics are not in your favor, right? And this doesn't even go into the account, like into the fact that like were the out of the 173, who was actually successful, right? And so it's really interesting, but this kind of validates that that thought of, you know, you better think about commercial strategy really early on, because it's going to be crucial. And I always kind of say, you know, some of the hardest things you're going to do, raise money for one, like get your med tech product funded. But the second thing is commercialize it, right? Maybe you're lucky enough that you can achieve some awesome clinical data that you just exit it, but commercial traction is just, it's brutal.
I think it was compounded as well, Dwayne, in 2023 because we saw a dip in acquisition of companies. And so companies that were
Right.
banking on the fact that they would, you know, get a successful clinical study and then shortly after just get acquired with kind of just some pre-revenue stuff, it wasn't happening. And so if that was their strategy post-clinical, it kind of went by the wayside, right? From in 2023.
Yeah, you when you're building a company, obviously you want to have that exit in mind, but you better be prepared to build a successful med tech company. And if you're not thinking that way, this is how you kind of get into trouble. A few more categories. One's going to be investment by technology, the other is going to be investment by therapeutic area, and then also funding distribution by region. I'm curious on the investment by technology. I think it's important to call out, and you do this at the beginning of the article. You talk about, you know, what is med tech? In terms of how you've defined it here. And it's medical device in vitro diagnostic, software as a medical device slash digital therapeutics. So companies have to seek or bring a regulated technology to market. So that's how you're defining it. So in terms of the investments by technology category, which you have device, IVD, and software as a medical device. Maybe give us the breakdown of where that 18 billion went from a dollar perspective, and then also a number of companies.
Yeah, for sure. So device still sits at the top, right? Because the diversity in the types of medical devices and all of the different types of variations of technology that fits under that subcategory is so large that that investment still peaks above IVD diagnostic and software as medical device, especially because software is an emerging thing. We see almost, I think, a four times multiple in investment dollars, so about 13 billion versus 3.5 in IVD, right? Which sort of makes sense. But what was interesting was seeing the rise in software as a medical device and digital therapeutic investment plus the number of companies. If we look at the number of companies that were receiving those funding rounds in 2023, it's like 75% software as medical device companies versus IVD companies. So it's almost neck and neck, and IVD has been in the game for so long. So if you're thinking of rate of growth, right? Wow. Software as a medical device is really new in this space.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it can link with both device and diagnostics at the same time, right? If you think of connected devices, right. If you think about companies like Neuralink, right, that has an implantable chip, but that's got to connect to the cloud and to a piece of software that is doing something with that data. Neuromodulation devices, things like that, those can be amplified through software, and that's becoming more regulated by the FDA and by the European Union as well, right? So the investment dollars going into that is accelerating. And I think we're going to see more of that in 2024, this year. I wouldn't be surprised if the investment into software as a medical device and digital therapeutics goes above traditional IVD in this year, 2020.
Wow. Yeah. It makes total sense. You know, there's the software as a medical device space is so interesting, from the sense of, I think to your point, we'll see more companies fall into that this year as the FDA and the EU regulate more of it. I think in years past, you've been able to flirt this line of like, I'm not a medical device. I just aid in the diagnosis of a disease state or something like that. And the FDA is kind of cracking down on that a little bit. So I would expect to see that more devices are going to move from what was, you know, used to be classified as a clinical decision support device and now be an actual medical device. Clinical decision support tool, I guess, not a device. Yeah, that's really fascinating. What about therapeutic areas? Because I will say, when I read the report, there was one number that really jumped out at me, because up until then, I felt like this specific therapeutic area did not get a lot of investment dollars. So anyways, maybe share the numbers. I think you know what I'm talking about, but feel free to share some of these.
I mean, maybe you should start with the number that you were surprised about. And I'm almost betting I was surprised by the exact same number as you.
Yeah. Women's health being 12%. Yeah. And so you're going to share the other ones here. It's the third highest. That is surprising to me, because up until now, women's health has not gotten a ton of investment dollars. And that's been a real problem. We talked about this on another podcast episode. I think with Marissa Fayer would be the episode that it was in, maybe episode 131 or something like this. But anyways, yeah, share some of these numbers. But that one really stood out to me.
Yeah. And just a reminder, this is 12% out of the funding that was received, right? Not 12% of the market is women's health companies. Does that make sense? Out of the funding that received.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. Yep. Total sense. Yeah.
I was surprised as well by these numbers. These numbers don't make sense to me when going into this analysis. I went in with my own biases of, you know, cardiovascular is just going to get so much funding, right? Like that's the biggest in med tech. Everybody says that. You ask anybody, it's like cardiovascular is the main med tech therapeutic area all the time. It's actually second to neurology. So neurology is sitting at 16.6%. Cardiovascular is at 13.1%. Women's health is at 12%. And then next up is orthopedic, gastro. These is hovering around 10%. And then you got oncology at 9%, dental 7%, endocrinology at 6%, infectious disease 7%. Yeah, dermatology 5%. And then ophthalmology sitting the lowest at around 2.4%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I, I totally agree. I mean, the cardio, neuro, orthopedic, mm-hmm. that makes sense to me. The women's health jumped out at me. But that's really, really good to see. The gastro one, also not totally surprising. And the rest of it kind of fell in line with, yeah, I guess I really wouldn't have an opinion about it, but, this is really, really, a cool breakdown. I'll be interested to see the breakdown from 2023 to 2024, and see if any of these shifted around a lot or if it stayed the similar. I also wonder too, you know, it is $18 billion, so it's not like one major investment is going to sway these numbers all that much. I think it's a really interesting breakdown. Pretty cool. Anything big within here that stood out besides the cardiovascular for you?
Yeah, I think the neurology one is larger than cardiovascular. That stuck out to me. I think it took to scale probably because of software as a medical device investment. Right. If you think about it, like the major categories right. are prime for either software as a medical device as a whole being a solution, or it coupling to connected devices. Right? Like if you think about ophthalmology and orthopedic or dermatology, like you can't really have software as a medical device easily in those types of therapeutic areas. But for women's health, if it's, you know, some sort of wearable, implantable diagnostic device, that is easily cloud integrated or having a software component. Same with neurology, right? You got neuro stimulators, wearable devices as well in there. Cardiovascular, similar thing. I think that's the trend that I'm taking away here, is the future is going to see more and more investment, I think, in the blend of software as a medical device and traditional medical devices.
Yeah, I think the neuro world, to your point, I think there's a lot around neurodegenerative diseases, and trying to catch those early, but also differentiate which diseases they could be. And I think that software as a medical device probably plays a pretty big role in that. Very, very interesting to see. What about funding by region? I don't know how you broke it up from a regional perspective, but I'm curious on what you saw.
Yeah. I mean, we see the typical story here, right? I broke it up into three kind of regions. So North America, Asia Pacific, and EMEA, right? So Europe, Middle East, Africa. I would say this data doesn't sit too well with me from a accuracy standpoint from anybody, not just us. Because I think the sources of insight into those more remote countries and also remote regions, Asia Pacific especially, I think it's underrepresented in terms of the total amount and activity out there on both the med tech and the biopharmaceutical space, gotcha. From any data firm, just because of data accessibility, right? So I would say that those numbers are slightly underrepresented, whereas the North American numbers are more true to form. That being said, we're looking at a distribution of funding from that total funding we captured. 69% is within North American region, 24% in the EMEA, and then 7% in Asia Pacific of the $18 billion.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So this one is probably maybe the least confident in terms of not data accuracy, but data accessibility.
Data completeness, I would say.
You know, it's
in terms of region.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, it's It's actually funny. From a listener, this actually looks like Project MedTech's heat map from a listener perspective. We have about 65% of our listeners. Yeah, our 65% of our listening base is North American. About 20-25% is what you have classified here as like Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and then it's about 10% in the APAC, with Australia making up a pretty good stronghold there. But it was just funny. When you brought this up, I was like, that looks like our heat map. so in, I guess, kind of in conclusion then, like, what are you looking for in 2024? Or what excites you most? Like, if when we do this again next year, what are you going to be looking to kind of compare from 2023?
I'm looking to track the trend between investment into the technology types and therapeutic areas, because I'm almost willing to put money down that trend is going to go in favor of the software as a medical device route, right? And I think funding is going to increase by a lot, because in 2023, we can see that even though people are saying there's no funding, there's still a decent amount of funding. But that funding is even higher already in this first quarter, not higher than $18 billion, but it's already higher quarter per quarter that we're seeing from last year. So we'll actually be putting out another report, and we're going to break it down quarter by quarter and kind of track the play-by-play within 2024. And then we'll summarize and consolidate all of that for the end of 2024 this year as another version of this report. But now that we're almost up in the first quarter here, we're sitting on a lot of good data that we can put out a MedTech 2024 quarterly report here, status of the market.
Very cool. Awesome. So with that being said, people who are listening in, we'll have Zapyrus's website, in the show notes. We'll also have a link to the, report that Kevin and I were kind of referencing throughout this entire podcast. We'll have Kevin's LinkedIn also as a URL too. With that being said, Kevin, hang on for 1 minute, but really appreciate you taking the time to hop on the podcast today.
Anytime. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you need anything from us, you can contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. And for more information on Project MedTech, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.